All right, good morning. How's everyone doing today? Are we awake? Everyone's had their coffee. I told Krista to get an emergency batch of espresso ready to go here so we can get started. Well, hey, those of you who don't know me, my name's Pastor Clayton, or Clayton Garner, whatever you want to call me. But for the next 40 minutes, I only go by Reverend Clayton Garner. Only today. After the end of my sermon, it's no longer allowed. But excited to be with you guys today. And guys, I just want to say, we need to make Brent leave more often. What's it going to take? I don't know. But he does not take off enough, so I'm glad he got away for a little bit. We love Pastor Brent and Melissa. I came here almost 5 years ago as an honoree, young and maybe slightly dumb at times kid. And Brent's done nothing but love me and Katie and show us how to lead and show us how to raise a family. And I tell you guys, he loves his church more than anything. And really set a great example for me, so I'm thankful for that. And one more quick announcement. I just want to say thank you to all of you guys. We are leaving for camp tomorrow, and it gets better. All of our kids are going for free, and that's because of your generosity, so thank you. We got 16 going, scotch-free. So thank you for pouring into the lives of our kids, and we're really excited for what's going to happen this week. So if you get bored this week and start thinking about us, maybe say a quick prayer for our kids, it's going to be a great time. Well, anyways, I had a little bit of a struggle. Whenever I get put in here to preach, I struggle with what to preach on because I get one service. I know you guys don't want me to preach for an hour, and I have trouble not stuffing everything into 1 week. And so I was really struggling this week, and I was talking last week to Brent, and he said, hey, you know what? Just pick a random minor prophet and go with it. And I sat at home. I was like, I want a challenge, okay? You know, often, you know, you hear the same sermons over and over again. I want to preach on something. One, I've not really studied. And two, something I've never heard preached in church before. So I happened to be sitting at home. And as a young man, you know, I was sitting on the internet. And I'm a big fan of sports radio. Anyone here watch sports radio, sports television? Okay. Big fan. And I saw this old clip of a guy named Max Kellerman. Anyone ever heard of Max Kellerman? Okay, kind of an idiot, and because of that, sorry, I'm gonna get in trouble for that. My potty mouth on stage. I apologize, Pastor Brent. I apologize. But this is an old clip of them debating who should get the last shot in the NBA Finals game. Steph Curry, the greatest shooter of all time, or Andre Iguodala, a role player. You've never heard of him because he's a role player unless you watch basketball. And this guy goes, fate of the universe on the line. The Martians have the death beam pointed at the Earth. If they miss the shot, I want Andre Iguodala. Well, I sat there and said, you know what? I want Obadiah, all right? We're hopping into the book of Obadiah today. If you don't know your books of the Bible song, there's a good chance you didn't know that was a book of the Bible. Because if you're scrolling through the pages, you probably miss it. Obadiah is the shortest book in the Old Testament. It's about a page and a quarter of a page. But I think it's a pretty good one. And I'm sorry if you guys, it's between that and the holy diver joke, and I went with sports. So anyways, Obadiah, it's a minor prophet. Minor does not mean it's less important. Minor means it just was pretty short. All right? And the book is not dated. We don't know exactly when it was going on. But the book addresses a group of people called the Edomites. All right? Fun word there. This probably raises the question to you, what in the world is an Edomite? I had the same question as well. This book is dealing with a previous Bible story we all heard in kids' church about two brothers named Jacob and Esau, all right? For those of you who don't know, Jacob and Esau were twin brothers. They were the son of Isaac, and when they came out, they saw Esau, the firstborn, and he was really hairy. I don't know about you guys. I've never seen a really hairy baby, but he came out. And he was hairy, and so they said, you know what, we're going to name you Esau. You know what Esau means? Hairy. Then Jacob come out, and they decided to name him Jacob. You know what Jacob means? Deceiver. Now, I don't know about you guys. I can imagine Malia over there getting Joel right after she gave birth. You know what, I'm going to name this kid Deceiver. What a great name. Back in the good old days, when you just decided your entire child's personality based off your first look. I can only imagine my mother holding me for the first time, looking at me and saying, you know what? I'm going to call him incredibly handsome. Pastor Zach, on the other hand, I don't even want to know what his mom was thinking. It wasn't good. Anyways, I'm going to move on. I'll move on here. Oh, goodness. But these two brothers couldn't have been more opposite, and because of that, they pretty much ended up hating each other. Esau was a big man's man. He was a hunter. All right? He was big. I imagine he'd drive the pickup truck, and in the back, he had a rifle mounted in the back seat. All right? Maybe had a motorcycle or two. Tatted up. Man's man. He wasn't any of those things. We're just trying to get you to get the picture here. Jacob, on the other hand, is quite different. Really close with his mom and was a really good cook. Do you see how those two might not get along as well? Okay. So these two brothers have a few issues. One time, Jacob's making a nice big old red stew. Does red stew sound good to anybody? I know Brent, if he was at the Indian restaurant and saw red stew, would probably order it. I'll stick with the chicken fried rice. But Jacob is making this red stew, and Esau comes home from a hard day of hunting and gathering. Wants some red stew. Says, hey, I'll give you the red stew if you give me your birthright. And Esau says yes, because he's really hungry. And then later on, right before Isaac is about to die, Jacob's mom wants him to get a double portion of the inheritance. So she puts a bunch of fur coats on top of him to make him seem hairy and sends him in to get his dad's blessing. They tricked him and deceived him into giving him the blessing. Can you imagine being that hairy? I'm imagining Sasquatch walking around with how they describe this guy. But believe it or not, after that, Jacob and Esau didn't really get along. And Esau goes on to make the country of Edom and Jacob the Israelites. And they hated each other ever since. So even after these two are dead, these two nations are warring with each other. They're arguing, they're bickering. And in our story today, Obadiah is actually writing this prophecy, this vision he was given from God, to the people of Edom. Kind of similar to the way they sent Jonah to Nineveh. He's telling the people of Edom, because of how they've acted, he is going to destroy them. So, the two main themes. One, the Lord is going to punish them to the extent that they no longer exist as a nation. Pretty extreme. And number two, the nation of Israel is going to be restored in the coming days. So earlier I said that this book wasn't dated. We don't know exactly when it was. But we do know that at this point in time, Israel's been under attack. And they've been overtaken. Now, a good educated guess would say it was probably the Babylonians. But during this time, as they're being overtaken, the country of Edom, nation of Edom, is looking at them and saying, you know what? I want to get it on the action here. We hate Israel so much, we're going to get in and make their life even more miserable while they're being attacked. So, as there's Israelites running away, the people of Edom are going up and arresting them and taking them to Babylonians and saying, here, I found one for you. While their towns are getting ransacked, they're going and overtaking them for themselves. Pretty much what they're doing is while their enemy is getting shoved to the ground, they're going out and giving it the final kick. And God wasn't very happy with it. So we're going to start off the beginning of Obadiah today. And if you got your Bible, you may have to look at the table of contents. Whole page and a half. All right, here we go. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. We have heard a report from the Lord, and a messenger has been sent among the nations. Rise up, and let us rise against her for battle. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You shall be utterly despised. The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in clefts of the rock, in your lofty dwelling, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground? Those of you who don't know, the nation of Edom was in a very rocky, mountainous area. For ancient warfare, the higher you were, the better. They thought no one was going to overtake them, no one's going to punish them because of where they were located, and it was causing some pride in their heart. But we know that, you know, we serve a pretty powerful God who's powerful than some rocks. It goes on. Though you soar aloft like the eagle, though your nest is set among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. If thieves came to you, if plunderers came by night, how you have been destroyed. Would they not steal only enough for themselves? If grape gatherers came, would they not leave gleanings? How Esau has been pillaged, his treasures sought out. All your allies have driven you to your border. Those at peace with you have deceived you. They have prevailed against you. And those who eat your bread have set a trap beneath you. Will I not on that day, declares the Lord, destroy the wise men of Edom and understanding out of Mount Esau? And your mighty men shall be dismayed, O Teman, so that every man from Mount Esau will be cut off by slaughter. Because of the violence you have done to your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off forever. On that day, you stood aloof. On the day that strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. But do not gloat over the day of your brother and the day of his misfortune. Do not rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their ruin, and do not boast in the day of distress. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Do not gloat over his disaster in the day of his calamity, and do not loot his wealth in the day of his calamity. And do not stand at the crossroads to cut off his fugitives, and do not hand over his survivors in the day of their distress. I know there was a lot there, but I want to go quickly over the things that God is telling them they did wrong. What were they doing that was sinful? What is he destroying them for? The first thing he says, standing aloof. You ever heard that before? Standing aloof. James chapter 4, verse 17 says, "So whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin." It's a new one for me. I learned that. Sorry, I want to point it out. Not only were they standing aloof, they were gloating, boasting, rejoicing, and entering the gates during the day of their calamity. This is why God is destroying their nation. Back into verse 15. "For the day of the Lord is near upon all nations. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deeds shall be returned on your own head. For as you have drunk from my holy mountain, so all the nations shall drink continually. They shall drink and swallow, and shall be as though they had never been." Think of the translation, it talks about God's cup of wrath being handed them. This is actually a common theme in the Bible. Jeremiah chapter 25, verse 15 through 17 says, "Thus the Lord, the God of Israel, said to me, take from my hand this cup of wine of wrath and make all nations who I send to you drink it. They shall drink and stagger and be crazed because of the sword that I am sending among them." Also, when Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane, in Matthew chapter 26, it says, "And going a little further, he fell on his face and prayed, 'My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will.'" So the Lord is promising them their destruction. His wrath is coming upon them. "But in the Mount Zion, there shall be those who escape, and it shall be holy. And the house of Jacob shall possess their own possessions. The house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau shall be stubble. They shall burn them and consume them, and there shall be no survivor left in the house of Esau." We're going to skip the next couple of verses. But a couple of things that stood out to me while I was studying. If you look to your right and you look to your left, there's a lot of different people in here. None of them are Edomites, all right? The Edomites are gone. That nation was destroyed. So this prophecy came true. It wasn't Sodom and Gomorrah style. We didn't have fireballs coming down and destroying them. But it's no longer here. Babylon ends up going in and destroying Edom in the 6th century. And one quick little history note I wanted to give you. The most famous Edomite you've probably ever heard of, his name was King Herod. All right, he had some bitterness. You can tell how much they hated each other. It carried on generation and generation and generation. But the one thing that really stuck out to me as I was studying for this sermon is how two brothers went from hating each other to being two warring nations who couldn't stand each other. And that's where my title came today, Family Feud. We watch as Jacob and Esau split off with their own nations, and they hate each other. And it brings us to this conflict, and ultimately, the destruction of Edom. I don't know about you guys, but I've been in a few slugfests with a sibling. Anyone ever had a slugfest with a sibling before? Nobody? No one wants to raise their hand? All right. Pastor Mark would call them the good old knockdown dragout. All right? Had to put a little accent on there. I don't know about you guys, but I've been in plenty of fight with a sibling, and whether they're physical or verbal, sometimes they can get pretty nasty. But this has got to be one of the nastiest brother-sister dragouts I've ever seen. It's something that stuck with them through generation and generation and generation. The book of Obadiah is heartbreaking in a way because we get to watch as what happened to two brothers becomes warring nations who are committing atrocities against one another. The Edomites hated Israel so much they actually enjoyed and wanted to watch them suffer. The pain that Israel was already going through wasn't enough for them. They wanted to come and add a little bit more on top. I don't know about you guys, but I know in my own life there's been a time where I've had to have a similar fight. All of us have had people in our lives who have hurt us, who have wronged us, who have annoyed us, people who are hard to deal with. And there's been times I've wanted to throw a little bit more gas on their fire. But the truth is, and what I realized as I was studying, is that God is holding us to the same standards He was holding the nation of Edom in the book of Obadiah. Proverbs chapter 24, verses 17 through 18 says, "Do not rejoice when your enemy fails. And let not your heart be glad when he stumbles, lest the Lord see it and be displeased and turn his anger away from him." Two quick points I had from our story today. One, kicking your enemy is missing the mark. Kicking your enemy is missing the mark. In kids' church, I always tell them, sin is anything you say, think, or do that's displeasing to God. I'll make it even simpler for you. Sin is missing the mark. I think Esau and the country of Edom are a great example of letting anger and vengeance fester in your heart and what it can do to a person, a family, a nation, or even a church. They missed the mark. Job chapter 31, Job says, "If I have rejoiced at the ruin of him who hated me, or exulted when evil overtook him, I have not let my mouth sin by asking for his life with a curse." In our own human nature, it's easy to seek out vengeance. Our flesh tells us we should enjoy our enemy when they're suffering. Our flesh tells us to kick our enemy while they're down, to celebrate when the person we don't like begins to stumble. I once heard a pastor talking about how he just preached a message on forgiveness. And he had a young lady down at the altar who was crying. He said, "Why are you crying?" She goes, "Well, I probably should have been praying for this person who wronged me for years. But I was afraid if I did, God might forgive them and they might turn their life around." There's a power in grudges. There's a power in hatred, and it's not a good one. Holding on to grudges and hatred for people in your heart, as we see in the book of Obadiah, can be detrimental not only to your walk with the Lord, but also to the relationships that you have. Look what a grudge between two brothers turned into. Two entire nations that hate each other so much that they were celebrating a country getting ransacked, looted, and overtaken. But I'm not going to lie. The kind of behavior talked about in Obadiah is something that we see every day in our world. Whether it's work, whether it's family, whether it's church, We all have these issues of hatred and grudges that can be detrimental to your environment. This message can easily be against hatred in general, but I think this story hits on the head of what it's like when you celebrate seeing your enemy stumble. It's about how we treat people that we may not get along with, people who have wronged us. Do we love them? Do we show them mercy? Or do we kick them while they're down? I think often, even in the church world, we see people kick people while they're down. People we don't enjoy. We like it when we see them stumble, when they do the wrong thing. We say, hey, you got what you deserved. I can tell you this. There's a person I know who constantly kicks people when they're down. I've never seen Satan say, hey, you know what? Pastor Zach's had a hard week. I'm just going to give up for a couple days and leave him alone. He doesn't. He keeps kicking and kicking and kicking. But God's love is the opposite. The heart of the Father is mercy. And that leads to my second point today. Worship team, you can, if I can get a guitar or piano or something, that'd be cool. Maybe a sick drum solo for the altar call. Anybody with me? Okay. Number two, have mercy in the face of persecution and opposition. I'm reminded of 1 Peter chapter 3, and it says, now who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled. But in your heart, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. For it is better to suffer for doing good, if that should be God's will, than for doing evil. Those of you who know me know that I love the game of basketball. If you don't, you know now. You can ask a few people here. When I'm on the basketball court, I'm super level-headed, no trash talk. Just a real humble, level-headed guy. Right, Pastor Mike? I was reminded of a story. I got out of college, and I was applying to be a work at the rec center at my college, and I had an interview that morning. I was really excited. I thought it went really well, and then that night I was going to play some basketball. And if you ever played church league basketball, it's really nice. You know? Usually people are really pleasant, real godlike atmosphere. Church basketball is nasty, I'm going to tell you right now. But there's this one guy I really didn't get along with. I'm not going to say his name. He's a good guy, but me and him never saw eye to eye. And he's a little stouter guy than I was, a little taller. And all night long, this dude is beating the snot out of me, just laying me out. And believe it or not, I kind of kept a cool head. But towards the end of the night, I went up for a layup, and all of a sudden, I take a clothesline to the neck as I get laid out on the ground. I'm going to tell you, I never got up so fast with my fists clenched ready to go. And I got in his face, and I was getting ready to slug him. And something hit me, and it's like, you know what, I'm not going to do this. One of the hardest things I ever did, I'm telling you. Turn around and walk away. Luckily for me, the guy who interviewed me that morning was watching and hired me the next day. But my point in this story is, choosing grace and mercy for our enemies isn't always easy. And I know what it's like to have someone wrong you. I know what it's like to have someone hurt your feelings. I know what it's like to have someone get on your nerves. But the heart of the Father is mercy. It's hard to move on with our lives without getting the last say. It's hard to move on without getting the last punch. Our flesh wants to fight back. We have to choose instead to align our hearts with the heart of the Father. I think Jesus said it best. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes the sun rise on the evil and the good, and sends the rain on the just and the unjust. So my question to you today is, how do you treat your enemies? How do you treat the person who's hurt your feelings? How do you treat the person who sinned against you? How do you treat the person who grinds your gears like nobody else? I've had a few enemies in my life. I still hate the Boston Celtics, I'll tell you that right now. But it's that hard point of trusting God and asking Him to do something in your life that's a struggle to do on your own. And that's to have grace and mercy. If you guys would all stand up with me for a minute. I've seen too many times, I've seen people who let anger and grudges and hatred sit inside their heart, where they'll let it drive apart their family, their office, or even their church. I want to encourage you today to ask God to help you with forgiveness. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to open up this altar, and I encourage you to come down. If there's any kind of bitterness, anger, a grudge you might have, I'm going to encourage you to come up. One, ask for forgiveness, but then ask God to help you have forgiveness with that person. Because believe it or not, it may be hard for you to turn away, but with God, I believe we can show grace and mercy and compassion even to those who we might feel don't deserve it. So this altar's open. The worship team's going to start singing. And I encourage you, even if it's small, don't let that fester inside. Let's just come to the altar today and surrender it all to the Lord. Just come on up.
I've carried a burden too long on my